Our next speaker is Dr. Joanne Shatkin. She's the principal of the Cadmus Group, and she's had extensive experience in human health risk assessment, managing over 60 environmental risk assessment studies. She's currently president of the New England chapter for Society for Risk Analysis, active in a number of other panels on the risk assessment, and she's going to tell us about assessing the risks of nanoscale materials. So, welcome.
Thank you.
While we're swapping computers, I want to thank all the speakers for their incredible professionalism in staying on time. As the person who comes up here and chases off the ones that don't, I really appreciate how well they stayed on time.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be here with so many interesting and distinguished speakers today. Especially our last speaker was a great introduction to this talk. As I think we all would agree, nanotechnology holds great promise to benefit society and to reduce risks from our current technologies. But how do we ensure that nanotechnology fulfills this promise? We need to do our work and proceed in a way that we identify and address both real and perceived concerns about the technologies as they develop. Today I'm going to discuss risk assessment as an approach to systematically identify, evaluate, address, and communicate about both the real and perceived health and environmental concerns associated with nanotechnologies. Briefly about the Cadmus Group, we're an international environmental organization. We help groups to develop and implement policies in drinking water, energy, and indoor environments. And I lead the health risk assessment practice and work with clients to evaluate emerging contaminants and develop science to support sound decision making. Brief overview of what I'll talk about this morning is why we ought to be concerned about nanoscale material impacts, the importance of addressing risks now, and risk assessment distinguishing it from hazard evaluation. More about assessing risks of nanoscale materials, and finally, an adaptive risk-based decision-making framework that my colleagues and I are applying and developing for health and safety decision-making of nanotechnology and nanomaterials. So why should we be concerned? Well, the very properties that make nanomaterials and nanotechnology so attractive are the same ones that raise concerns about their impacts in biological systems. They are operating at a quantum level. They have a great surface area with respect to particle size. They're adaptable. They're easily manipulated, and there are quantum effects. They hold unique properties that their bulk equivalents do not, and that aren't predictable from the bulk equivalents either. We can look to history to learn our lessons that we must take action now in the early stages of a technology's development. We don't want to replace our existing technologies, the issues associated with them, with a new technology, with new problems. For example, we can look at lead. When lead was first developed for industrial use, it held such great properties and so much promise that it was widely introduced into a variety of products, including gasoline and paints and pencils. And now we are faced with the legacy of lead in our environment. We don't want to replace our old problems with new ones. Nanotechnology is developing rapidly. Technologies are being discovered at a very fast pace and continue to increase with time. And there's very little information about the impacts associated with nanotechnologies. And there's great potential for wide dispersion, given that nanotechnology and nanomaterials are being widely introduced in various sectors of the economy and most likely will continue to do so. Finally, there are not yet standards for nanotechnologies, but there likely will be. We could take this cartoon and replace genetically modified foods with nanotechnologies and ask, are they safe? But are they safe is not the right question for us to ask. Rather, we should ask, are there potential risks associated with nanotechnologies? And if so, how do we effectively manage those? We can do a better job than the panelists in this cartoon in answering that question. A brief overview of risk analysis. How would you assess the risks of nanoscale materials? Begin by identifying and characterizing the problem. And as our last speaker pointed out, you can look across the entire life cycle, or you could look at a single aspect of the process, say, for manufacturing. But the hazard identification and characterization really defines the problem. What is it that you're going to analyze? There's a recent framework that's been released from the International Life Sciences Institute that suggests that that materials be characterized by size, shape, surface area, composition, surface charge, physicochemical structure, agglomeration state, porosity, method of production, storage, concentration, contamination level. These are all novel. This is not how we typically characterize materials when we're going to evaluate the risks associated with them. The next step would be to assess the exposure potential. How is exposure likely to occur and when? What is the matrix? What is the setting? What are the human and environmental exposures that could occur? Then evaluating the toxicity. Each material that's developed has different properties, and these are going to behave differently in environmental systems. So the toxicity does need to be evaluated. It can be inferred in some cases from other types of materials with similar structure or with similar chemical composition. It's still very early. The word was coined this year, nanotoxicology, and it's a really new and emerging field. Then all of this information is put together to characterize risk. In addition to characterizing risk, at this point, it'd be fair to say you're characterizing uncertainty associated with risk. And finally, then, to communicate about the risks and make decisions about them. Briefly, to differentiate hazard from risk, any material that we can discuss is toxic at some concentration. If we drank water to the point of depleting our body of electrolytes, water would become toxic to our body. So we don't want to consider that no material is completely safe. But we do need to consider that if there's no exposure to that material, there is no risk. And the dosing is going to be important. So we would then define risk as the hazard, as we've characterized it, as well as the likelihood of exposure. This means that just doing a toxicity evaluation doesn't answer the question of whether the material is likely to pose a risk. So in the interest of beneficial nanotechnology, we can consider risk assessment that it's going to be the basis for environmental decision-making. The EU has just released an opinion on this. The U.S. has started a voluntary program to gather data to begin risk characterization. OECD and other organizations are also looking at how to do risk assessment for decision making. Risk assessment allows making decisions under uncertainty. So we recognize it's going to take a long time to have all the answers about the risks. We're going to be working in an environment of uncertainty. But we can make decisions about application and proceeding with the technology amidst that uncertainty using this approach. Risk assessment keeps pace with technology. It can prioritize research directions. Because where you identify key uncertainties, you can focus your research in that area. Can also identify areas for product innovation. It may be that there's some intractable issues associated with a current direction that can lead you to point in a different or perhaps more beneficial direction. And it reduces potential for unforeseen impacts if you start to look at these issues early on. This risk-based adaptive decision framework that we're developing has many features. It's a screening tool to identify and prioritize health and process issues. I'm not suggesting that it's a detailed assessment of every aspect of health and environmental risk at each step within the life cycle, but it is a tool that can be used to prioritize those evaluations. It's a dynamic approach. It applies very broadly. It's a framework that can be applied to a range of types of hazards. And it serves to identify the key uncertainties that relate to making decisions about the level of risk associated with technologies or how they proceed or how they're managed. And it allows you to revisit early decisions when new information becomes available, which it does frequently. And it applies to health and safety concerns, not just for workers, but also for users and for environmental receptors. This framework steps sequentially across processes throughout a product life cycle and evaluates risk at each step. A key is that it focuses on this potential for exposure, because you could spend all of the resources of the National Nanotechnology Initiative trying to understand the toxicity of these materials and still not have all the answers you need. This is a way to prioritize where resources are expended. It's a transparent decision framework, so it allows comparison of different products and processes amidst uncertainty by looking at similar attributes of them and evaluating them in a consistent way. And it's a proactive approach to evaluate safety. So how does this all work? Well, we can start by looking at the raw materials, the inputs to a process or a technology, and then the process itself. What comes out of the process or processes, each one of these could involve many steps that could be individually evaluated. Again, characterizing, identifying the characterization at the beginning, which part of this process do you want to focus on, as far out as the use, and then we could even go further into the end use or the disposal or the recycling of the material, for example. We would start by identifying and characterizing the hazards of the raw materials and step through. Assessing the exposure would be the next step. Where there are potential for exposure, where there is potential, then evaluating the toxicity at those various steps. We can see, you could move through each one of these processes broadly. Assessing the exposure at each of these processes. And evaluating toxicity where you identify, exposure potential to be of import or of concern. And then characterizing risk at each of these processes. Then you've got the input information you need to make decisions. And if it appears that there are some concerns, then you can take mitigation measures at whichever of these steps, or perhaps revisit and gather more information. As an example, we can look at single-walled carbon nanotubes. I don't have time to go into a lot of the details of the studies, but we can briefly look at what are the hazards associated with carbon nanotubes. The production processes appear to be generally in closed systems, so there aren't a lot of exposures that occur during production, but post-production exposure might be possible, say, during packaging of those materials. A recent exposure assessment measured the concentrations in air of single-walled carbon nanotubes during packaging phase. Those were in the microgram per cubic meter range of particles that are about 1 to 4 microns generally. And we can then look at a toxicity evaluation. There have been several studies evaluating the toxicology of single-walled carbon nanotubes. One of these found inflammatory responses in the lung following an intratracheal administration, which means that the material was not inhaled, it was simply placed into the lung in a liquid matrix. And it found that there were adverse effects that occur. But that has to be tied back to the exposure. So there is a bit of a disconnect here because that wasn't actually an inhalation exposure, in part because it's very difficult right now to characterize the exposure conditions and to make measurements. It's unclear what the actual metrics ought to be for characterizing exposure. It does appear that the number of particles as opposed to the concentration of them is a key parameter, as well as the surface charges, the particle sizes, and numerous other attributes such as the shape of the particles. The list that I read earlier all affect this, so that while the exposure assessment suggests that concentrations may be lower than those that were in this toxicity evaluation, that is on the basis of mass or concentration, and that may not be the appropriate measure. So that if we're going to characterize the risk, we can say, well, there may be some toxic responses. It's possible. We have seen from some early studies that may be the case, but that exposures appear low by concentration, but there's really a lot of uncertainty about the key characteristics, suggesting that exposure ought to be avoided or mitigated now, and better data regarding exposures ought to be explored as a response. Along these lines, the CADMIS group is organizing and co-sponsoring workshops on risk analysis for nanoparticles. This December at the Society for Risk Analysis, there'll be a symposium that I've organized on the issue of regulatory versus voluntary approaches for nanoparticles. And in the fall of 2006, CADMIS will be co-sponsoring a workshop with the Johns Hopkins Institute on conducting risk analysis of these materials. So to summarize, nanotechnology holds great potential. I think we would all agree with that. But we can look even to our recent past to see that there are some indicators that ask us to look more carefully. For example, methyl tert-butyl ether was added to gasoline as an additive. While the jury is still out on the toxicology some 20 years later, we've found now that it's a very mobile substance and is moving rapidly through the environment. We perhaps could have known that early on and made some better decisions about its use as an additive before we released it widely into the environment. We here have an opportunity and an obligation not to repeat those mistakes and to address the concerns now. There are benefits to reducing risks early, too. There are financial benefits in having a lower risk product, in having a lower cost to operate and to ensure operations, in reducing liability, and also in being able to communicate with regulators and with investors about materials and technologies. And finally, I believe that risk assessment is an approach that frames the key issues and allows us to address the concerns. Thank you. I'm sure we all want to get to lunch, but are there any questions? Thank you.
Oh. I have a question, which is on a lot of these studies, the preparation has a lot to do with the toxicity, especially at the nanoscale, to get the materials dispersed. Is there some work to standardize the preparation of these kind of things?
The question is that the preparation of materials has a lot to do with the toxicity that results from them, and that is a key concern. For example, the studies that I was citing about solid single-walled carbon nanotubes, they were comparing just two of maybe perhaps a dozen different processes to develop these materials, and each is associated with a different level of contamination, purity, particle size, length, each of those is likely to have an impact. And I believe that we need to do a better job of defining the terms of how we do the studies before we even begin to compare the different processes. But each of those are likely to impact the toxicity.
Yes, I wonder if you have in risk analysis given to using nanoscale. Okay. Am I on? Yes. Have you given thought to sort of flipping this paradigm and using nanoscale measurement? The nano level as a way to reduce risk in other areas such as Food and Drug Administration approvals and other things. In other words, looking at nanoscale abilities as we explore this technology as a risk assessment tool, not just something to measure, because nanoscale is right here. It's here. It looks to me like we do better if we can see deeper and deeper at that level. There not only is plenty of room at the bottom, there is no bottom. We can keep looking deeper.
Certainly one of the sectors that I envision nanotechnology is going to greatly impact is our ability to understand the effects of various contaminants in the environment on biological systems. The ability to see at the molecular level and do testing at that level will have a great impact on our understanding of the mechanisms of toxicity, and then will give us the greater power to design around that.
I have a question. The present regulations that govern chemicals at macro scale are being applied by the government, at least for now, to nanoscale materials as they are being developed. Could you comment on that?
I have many thoughts on that topic. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is looking at using the Toxic Substances Control Act and their powers under that to regulate nanotechnologies. However, they recognize that the way that we are currently reporting new materials does not distinguish the key features of nanomaterials. It doesn't distinguish the size, the shape, the composition, the porosity, the key parameters that distinguish one type of material from another. And there is a suggestion, actually, from the European Union, who is looking to use their proposed REACH program for nanomaterials, that the CAS system have an additional add-on so that the key characteristics can be identified with these new materials so that carbon nanotubes can be distinguished from fullerenes from graphite, which they can't be under the current system. I think that's a great proposal. I don't think we understand what those characteristics are at this time, and I think there's a lot of work to do in developing a standardization for that. My understanding of what the U.S. government is doing right now is gathering data in order to make decisions. They have approved a few materials. One of them was because of a low exposure exclusion under TSCA.
Saturday morning, I think, was Peter Diamandis would take a look at one of your slides where he said there's no risk there's no risk if there is no exposure. He would claim that, and I think I agree with him, that it's the risk of aversion that is killing us in this country. But that's just my comment. My question is, how much does your risk aversion process take Moore's Law into account? The idea that as technology progresses, we'll be able to fix some of the things that are to show up.
This isn't a risk aversion process, is the way I view it. It's an assessment and characterization process. I guess my view of our ability to manage risks after we've created them is that we're probably better off not to create them in the first place. We have the tools now to, if we're going to be doing molecular manufacturing, to design with the end in mind, I believe that the potential for that is that we don't have to then fix problems. We can, after we've created them, instead we can fix them as we're creating them. We can identify them simultaneously.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.